This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. Merrill Loeffler is here, poet, publisher, physicist, more, and much more. And here he is with a poem.
So this is what I want of it. I want it to graze like gazelles and soar with the aplomb of eagles. I want it to rise like a palace out of syllables of breath. I want it to undo locked gates with obscure incantations. I want it to open closed minds and lead them into the meadows of starlight. I want it to light up the night with meteors of radiance and desire. I want it to inflame the coldness of my heart and set passion on fire. I want it to waken the mountain gods and startle the dead from boredom. I want to revive my ancestors and ask for their blessings. I want it to guide me through deserts year after year and lead me to water and wild fruit. I want it to open my eyes and reveal angels ascending and descending in my own backyard.
That is the voice of Merrill Loeffler. We will be talking today about Passover and poetry with Merrill. But before we do that, what do you like about that poem?
I think there are a number of things for me. One, it's the rhythm, the long the long lines, the short lines, but it's the sound. You know, it's and I would hope that it has music in the in its rhythms, and at the same time there are allusions, very subtle allusions, to aunt's blessings, ancestors. Deserts, we're talking about Passover today and more poetry today. But that's, the Hebrews, Moses led them through the desert for 40 years to get to the so-called promised land.
Yes. So tell us what Passover is.
Well, one way I can tell you, I'd like to read a poem by Primo Levi, the Italian memorist and storyteller, called simply Passover. And it sets out, I think, it's like a prolegomena, prolegomena. It's just simply called Passover. And one of the, probably the most famous line in the Haggadah, which we'll talk about, and that is the telling of this Passover story, is, why is this night different from other nights? Ma nishtanoa halaylo hazeh, in the Hebrew. Tell me, how is this night different from all other nights? How, tell me, is this Passover different from other Passovers? Light the lamp, open the door wide so the pilgrims can come in. Gentile or Jew, under the rags, perhaps the prophet is concealed. Let him enter and sit down with us. Let him listen, drink, and celebrate Passover. Let him consume the bread of affliction, and the bread of affliction is matzah, unleavened bread. Let him consume the bread of affliction, the paschal lamb, sweet mortar, and bitter herbs. This is the night of differences, in which you lean on your elbow on the table. Since the forbidden becomes prescribed, evil is translated into good. We will spend the night recounting far-off events full of wonder, and this is the story of the Exodus. And because of all the wine, the mountains will skip like rams. Tonight they exchange questions, the wise, the godless, the simple-minded, and the child. And time reverses its course today, flowing back into yesterday. Like a river enclosed at its mouth, each of us has been a slave in Egypt. Soaked straw and clay with sweat and crossed the sea dry-footed. You too, stranger. This year in fear and shame, next year in virtue and in justice.
That's from enslavement, rejoicing.
And that is what Passover celebrates. It celebrates, we're celebrating the book of Exodus, basically, and that is the Hebrews, the Israelites, who were slaves in Egypt, yearning to be free. And this is the story of Moses leading them with God's help, so the story goes, with much struggle, more than struggle, against the Egyptians, the Pharaoh who would not let them go each time God visited another plague upon them. And the Pharaoh relented and then turned back. So then there was another plague. And finally, the last plague, which is really devastating, in which God says that he will smite the firstborn of all the, of the Egyptians. And Pharaoh finally relents, but not without going after them again. So, this is a tale of, God's intervention to bring the Israelites, to freedom.
That's beautifully said. And so with such a complexity, it's really said so clearly and concisely. I understand everything. You'd be surprised. Many of us did not know exactly what the Passover was. Mm. We knew what the celebration was.
Well, it's a wonderful festival, and it's a festival that has been going on for 2,500 years at least. I mean, it's changed and it's adapted. And when I say adapted, the essential story is the same, but the way we interpret it,
yes,
changes. And it is a significant story. And I brought along with me, an address by Martin Luther King.
I wanted to say something about that because it is the largest meaning of Passover. It's about the freedom from slavery.
That's what it is.
And so therefore, mm-hmm, I think it touches many cultures.
Right. Well, it does. And here is Martin Luther King. And this was in 1957 at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. "I want to preach this morning from the subject, The Birth of a New Nation," King writes, "and I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together a story that has long since been stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. It is the story of the Exodus, the story of the flight of the Hebrew people from bondage of Egypt to the wilderness and finally in the Promised Land. It's a beautiful story. The struggle of Moses, the struggle of his devoted followers as they sought to get out of Egypt, and they finally moved on to the wilderness where they wandered for 40 years and toward the Promised Land. This is something of the story of every people struggling for freedom. It is the first story of man's explicit quest for freedom." And this was not the only time that Reverend King referred to the Exodus. I will just read one more line from another, April 3rd, 1968, the next day he was assassinated. But the last sentences are, "I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the Promised Land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the Promised Land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord."
And the Promised Land harks back.
The Promised Land harks back to the story of the Exodus.
And we would never have put that together.
Yeah.
It has to be pointed out to us. Merrill is a poet. He was the poet laureate of Tacoma Park, Maryland, not too long ago, where he's done some fabulous things. Some of them are the placards of poetry and visuals that are all throughout the city. And is that still going on every spring?
In working with design students at Montgomery College, I did that for 6 or 7 years. So there are over 250 posters. And so they are being recycled. Poetry is being recycled. And this is through the Friends of the Tacoma Park, Maryland Library, which is doing this.
And that's just one of the things. You had a great reading series there. But that is nothing compared to your life, Merrill. He has three collections of poetry. The latest is Mark the Music. Taught literature at the University of Maryland and the United States Naval Academy for more than 20 years. Then worked with a Chesapeake Bay Science Group at the University of Maryland, the Sea Grant Program. He has a publisher of Dryad Press, which is the longest living press in Washington. It could be 50 years.
I think it's more.
More than 50. And so are we. And right. We'll hear more about this. Is our great pleasure to present Merrill, favoring the Passover, telling us more about what it is. But what he is as a man is something I will want to emphasize throughout this hour.
Okay, I would like to say one thing before. I'm going to read a poem or two of mine, but I want to read part of a poem, again, Passover, by the late Linda Paslett, who died just recently. And it's a longer poem, but I'm only going to read a section because I think this, to me, is how it reflects how poetry is so so much of a deep part of the of Passover, not that people even think about it. So let me read the first part of Linda's poem. I set my table with metaphor, the curling parsley, green sign nailed to the doors of God's underground, salt of desert and eyes, the roasted shankbone of a Paschal or Passover lamb, relic of sacrifice and bleating spring. Down the long table past shoots of a root they have been hacking at for centuries, you hold up the unleavened bread, this is matzah, a baked scroll whose wavy lines are indecipherable. Now, if you know something about the Passover, you would recognize. If you don't, then some of this will go by your head. But the thing about the telling of the story of the Passover at the Seder, and the Seder means order, and the Haggadah means telling the story. So when you hear we're going to read from the Haggadah, it's the festival. And in telling the story, when you, I mentioned before, why is this night different from other nights? Why on this night do we eat matzah or unleavened bread? Why do we dip herbs in salt water? It's all metaphor. The telling of the story is centered in symbolic foods that we take. So we dip green parsley, let's say, or into salt water. It's to remind us not only of the green of the growth, but also salty, the tears. The bitterness and tears. We have charoses, which is made up of fruits and nuts. So that's to give us a sense of sweetness. But some people will put a piece of horseradish on the charoses because, again, it's to remind us that with the joy and freedom that we are experiencing at the Seder table, there is also injustice. We are to remember. And that is the story I think that is so marvelous.
And
to
how
me.
About the wine?
And it's the wine. It's the sacrament that we're making. In fact, the Last Supper was Jesus at celebrating Passover, and his disciples. That's what they were doing. So, it's and there are a whole series of foods, and so you tell the story using these foods that we have symbolically leading up to the meal as we tell the story, and then there is an order to the Seder. That's what Seder means. It means the order. Again, there's room for much interpretation. But the essential story is the struggle is a struggle for freedom. And what Jews have enjoyed, the line that has been in there, from the beginning, is that we were all slaves of Egypt. Meaning we're not only identifying the history and the tradition, but it's also recognizing that today, with so many people enslaved, with so many, and literally enslaved, so many refugees in the world, as long as one person is not free, none of us is free. And so that's that identification with, with
Passover doesn't belong just to the Jews.
Well, no, not at all.
And this is Merrill Leffler talking, and he is a poet showing us how metaphor is central to Passover.
Yeah. So, yes. And there are a number of Jewish poets, and I have to say that in celebrating the Passover, you could be an Orthodox or ultra Orthodox Jew, or you can be an atheist, and everything in between. Because for me, and for many of us, Passover is
it's a human,
universal.
Yeah,
it is not Jewish-centric.
It's a human endeavor.
It's a human endeavor.
Mm.
And
so
and
happy.
That's what, I grew up with. And it's that sense of responsibility that you have for others as well. I have, one of my granddaughters has said to me that in coming to these, she's now at her 20s and very much committed to social justice issues. She said, she said that she felt that the, coming to the Passover Seders over these years, it ingrained, it's one of those things that informed her sensibilities. So we'll see. She's going to be going on to law school, so we'll see how that works. Anyway.
What are you going to read us?
Well, I'm going to read a poem. This is, these are not Passover poems, but they're related to this, the connection. So this is a poem.
By you.
By me. And they come out of this broadly Jewish experience, and which itself is comes out of my study and reading, less religious. George Steiner, a wonderful literary philosopher, for him, he said, the home of the Jews is the text. And I think for me, that's one of the...
You've devoted your life to the text.
So it's the text. So the title of this poem is called Intercourse, but it has a very important epigraph. Isaac Luria, who was a mystical rabbi, did not differentiate between organic and inorganic, organic and inorganic life, but insisted that souls were present everywhere and that intercourse with them was possible. So this is a poem of gratitude. It begins, and this is it. Thank you, say the shoes you have placed under the bed. And thank you, says the quilt, for the warmth of your skin. Thank you, says the window, for lifting my sash. And thank you, says the broom, for the grip of your hands. Thank you, says the shirt, for buttoning my sleeves. And thank you, says the pond, for throwing me stones. Thank you, says the bulb, for my planting in earth. And thank you, says the pen, for writing these lines. Thank you, says the book, for turning my page. And thank you, says the mirror, for your face each day. And thank you, says Delmore, who is the poet, for remembering my poems. And thank you, says the Torah, for chanting the Shema. And thank you, says my father, for the gift of your life. And my mother says likewise from the grave of my heart. And thank you, I reply, in my exit from here. Wherever I travel, you go with me there.
From the grave of my heart. Oh, Merrill, how that animates our life. How you show how we're lighted by the same thing, how we're animated. Let's have more.
Okay, well,
this is from Mark the Music, by the way. I think your third book.
Yeah. Some of these poems are, right. So this is a poem called Limits, and it will sound a little bit arrogant, but or could be. I hope it's not. This is in the voice of God. And I will just say, if you saw it on the page, I repeat the poem twice. I'm only going to read it once. But with the last line in the first part, and then the second doesn't have the last line, which means...
Why is that?
Let me read the poem first, and I'll tell you why. Limits. Here, says God, the author of us all, you are my invention. What can I say, he says, I too am limited in what I can create. Once I had an idea and worked like a poet driven mad by dreams, delighted like every god before me. With such powers, I imagined a brave new world and took it on with gusto. What hubris. After all, how much can I do? I also get writer's block. I too get depressed. I too have limits and am condemned to repeat myself. Meanwhile, you bother me with your petty woes. What about me? I too could use compassion. Some pity on your part wouldn't hurt. For God's sakes, what would you be without me, with even my dullest, even my dullest idea? Enough already. I have given you the outline. You make the plot. Go, Gollum, travel as you will. I wash my hands of you. You are no longer my business. P.S. If you'd like, you can keep in touch. The second repetition of this poem doesn't have that last line. And so it's for believers, I suppose, and those who are not. I will say that one of the things I've been doing often is using commentary, so you would see this on the page, in which there are other writers who have comments. So, for example, and so that goes in a smaller type down the side of the page. And I'll just give you an example with this poem. Baudelaire, God is the only being who, in order to rule, does not need to even to exist.
So in the margins.
In the margins.
You have editorial
margins,
comments.
Yes. Abraham Heschel. And again, these are comments that that I came across afterwards. And so, again, it's that linkage. You know, just as in the Passover Seder, I'm using an analogy now, we are connecting ourselves to a tradition. When I come across pieces that seem to me related, I say, well, I'd like to have them as in a conversation or a dialogue. So here is Abraham Heschel. Even God has problems. I'm not sure how we can help him. So at any rate.
How many comments do you have?
Well, I have just a few in this one. But I have poems which, if you saw a page of the Talmud, you would have a text from from the Torah or from another book, and then surrounding that would be all these comments of different rabbis over the ages, and ideally one doesn't displace another. They're all in conversation with each other, and it's to say that that we are connected. We're all conversing over time.
And I have to interject one thing. If you get a letter from Merrill, Merrill is the last of the great letter writers. I will get a letter of 5 pages, handwritten, with philosophical comments, with notations from other poets, for poetry connected, for little utterances from the Greeks or from present day. And you are the last of the great letter writers. But it's the same thing. You're always adding to marginalia in your life. You're connecting, always connecting, present-day poets with the past. Do you see yourself as that connector? Poetry's a great conversation, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, we have Pound's very famous line, make it new, make it new. But nothing is new under the sun, as we have in Ecclesiastes. We have different takes. We have different perspectives. But when you recognize we're not coming de novo, we are writing out of not only out of our lived experience, but out of our literary experience. We all have different experiences in that regard. And so when you're teaching, you are teaching poetry to different groups, you're bringing in poets who younger poets don't know of and don't know, it's not vertical. It's what I feel, and that's fine. But others have been there before and have.
And we're talking to a man who is a scientist, a physicist, and has been a professor. And he brings all of that to the page. And I would like to hear more of your own poetry.
Okay, I am going to read a poem called Rejoice. And
is it in Hebrew also?
Well, yeah, one of the things, I have four poems in here. Two poems were translated into Hebrew and two poems were translated into Yiddish. And they, because Hebrew and the Yiddish are written from right to left, and the English, of course, is written from left to right, I have them, so there's a column between them, if you saw it on the page.
On the page, yeah.
And in a sense, it's a spine, but it's a spine with separation. It's not that I'm, I come out of that heritage, but we're going in different directions, too.
But it's pretty on the page, aesthetically.
Yeah, aesthetically. So two of the poems were translated by Moshe Dor, of beloved memory, and
a great Israeli poet.
Wonderful. And Herman Taub, who
wrote Yiddish. And you have published both of them.
Yes, Herman Taub and Moshe Dor, along with Barbara Goldberg, mm-hmm. who we did a couple of wonderful books that they translated. So this is called Rejoice. What has the world to do with you, or you, or me? What can time, that unassailable abstraction, care? Or the moon, the sun, the stars, visible and invisible? Or the ocean rolling in at your door? Or the great oak outside that shades your thoughts? Or the finches feeding on seeds you have set out? Or the mountains implacable behind you? Or memories that have given up their hold, your mother in the far horizon, your father and all who have held you and spoken love to you from the beginning. Or say it, this life, which holds neither grief nor happiness in your coming or in your going, or the earth that will cover you, or the darkness that will gather your dust to itself, or the winds that may lift and scatter you anywhere, the sea, the sea's edge, the mountains, the forests, the earth once more. Rejoice, rejoice.
And that is a perfect word for Passover, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I still want to hear more.
Okay, so, you know, there are not many poems, at least in Mark the Music, that are in the first person.
I was just noticing that.
Yeah, I'm much taken by imagery and metaphor. In fact, I have a poem in here called Metaphor, in which metaphor speaks. But it's a little bit longer. So this is a poem called Take Hold. If there's nothing before you, take hold of it. You may be fortunate or not. Place it deep in your pocket, regardless. It is a possession as no other. When you are to leave and have made all your arrangements, when you are ordered to declare all your possessions, reach into the dark pocket. This is no symbol, traveler, no parable. Nothing is as whole as the space in the air you pass through, and it is yours if you will take hold of it. So I think there's a relationship.
A philosopher could spend a long time talking about that space and the hole that you pass through. We could do a whole course of study on that one. Poetry is large. It's big. It takes up a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going. Do you think that the young people realize the ancestry of being a human being and what civilization means in terms of poetry? I'm thinking only the saints.
Well, I don't know. You know, I can't read this because it's too long, but I might just give you a few lines if I can find it. The poems have been my teachers, along with everyone else. You know, Tennyson has a line from a great poem called Ulysses, and this is Ulysses in old age, in which he says, I can't rule anymore. People eat and sleep and feed and know not me. So he turns over his kingdom of Ithaca to his son Telemachus, and he leaves. He needs to travel, but it's a metaphor for moving on. A few of the lines are, all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams the untraveled world. And so that experience is not only your felt experience, your experience at home, your experience in school, but it's also those people who have meditated, who have tried to give words to feelings.
To the unsayable.
To say the unsayable. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want of it is. Finally, that's what I want of it, of poetry, of life.
But you have named things, Merrill, for us. You have, and in Mark the Music, more than anything, you name those things that are not sayable. So let's have another poem, and then we will move on.
Well, I'm just going to read you a few lines from the Republic of Imperishable Lines. And I was sitting one day and just thinking of the lines that were going through my head. You know, where else would they be going through?
I can just see you sitting there thinking of lines.
And I just started writing them down. And they were from, I annotated it, not in the book, because to see the world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, Blake. The world discharged with the grandeur of God, Hopkins. Trailing clouds of glory do we come, for in his morning's horizons he loves the sun and the sun loves him. Exuberance is beauty, energy is eternal delight. Surely some revelation is at hand, and I am dumb to tell. Well, it goes on, and so I've put these are lines from.
They're centos.
Yeah, well,
it's
a cento. It's a cento.
Oh, yes. So explain what that is.
A cento is a poem that's made up of other pieces of poems. I didn't know that I was doing that. Actually, that I was writing a
you
cento.
You overdid it because a cento means 10.
Right. Yeah, well, I overdid it. It's, I don't know how many lines are here, but they're probably about 60 or 70.
People need to get this book. Mark the Music. It is an immortal book. It is. And finally, what would you have as final words about Passover and poetry?
Well, you know, when I said before that, you know, and I realized that how central metaphor is, as I've said here, to Passover, to our telling the story, because that's how you remember. That's how, through images, through, you know, even if you can't explain them all, but it's very evident when you dip this green in salt water, we're remembering, you know, we're acknowledging the tears and, you know, and the greenness and growth and spring. After all, this is a springtime festival as well, and its origins may have been in that. Is what, you know, so even though we tell the story, it's, you know, it's a springtime. You know, I'll read one last poem, and this is part of a poem, and it's a poem about feet. Well, I shouldn't say about. It relates to feet, and
feet,
F-E-E-T, and the third part is this. What I know of Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, though it would not fill a shot glass, is this. To study Talmud into the night, he'd stick his feet in ice water and keep them there, it was said, to ward off sleep from spreading through his body. I have it on no authority, of course, but I would like to think it was his way to not forget his body while his soul set forth into the thick wilderness of God's law. Oh, Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, not even a smudge in my memory, not a pinprick in the history of the dead. I can imagine you at Matisse's table, the light holding you in place, dining on the sweet breath of life. Old men wringing from each hour the honey that flows like fire in the blood. Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, for God's sakes, who knows how you might have forsaken your wife for study, or for that matter, how you came to her in dark passion, your appetite for wisdom, like Solomon's, so full you met each other with gratitude and love. Oh, Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, I drink to the memory of your feet. May they live in incandescent to light even the darkest way.
The voice of Merrill Loeffler, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, Natalie Canavore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.